If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Bro, the whole thing.
Winter, spring, summer, fall, seasons change. We still keep it together.
Hey, Beverly Hills 90210 fans. Are you ready to dive deep? Episode by episode. Storyline by storyline. Character by character. As we break down the making of your favorite zip code. With your host. Charles
Rosen.
Did
I say that?
Yeah. Barry Mullen.
This foolish thing about the real person. And we're going, what? We're getting rid of this guy.
Pete Ferrero.
I'm feeling wonderful. Kathleen looks crush, TV crush worthy.
Like so many special guests. And all your questions. Live on the Beverly Hills 90210 show. Oh, yeah.
Well, here we are back on the Beverly Hills 90210 show, and it's me and Chuck this week. We are the lone survivors. It's just down to the two of us.
So really, let's just make a statement. Pete is the lone survivor, and I'm humoring him. I survived. I survived. I really did. I survived these 5 years, and now it's all these years later, and I still miraculously find myself breathing.
Yes.
I might as well keep doing that, and as long as there's an interest that Pete has to, and the rest of you to look at some of these deep dives, especially we were just talking about the weirdness of season one, and and how long ago it truly was.
Let's say happy birthday to our buddy Larry Mullen. It's Larry Mullen's birthday. He's our other survivor. He's with us, but he's off getting ready for a big trip. I know his birthday's today. 76. I mean, listen, you know Larry Mullen a long time now.
Larry and I met in 1993, in the spring of 1993. So that means a long time ago. I wanted to say the one story. I was thinking, knowing we'd probably be talking a little bit about Larry. So Larry and I only pitched one project together, took it out on the network. And it was Larry's idea, and it was this kind of really funny idea about this hard-boiled, like, rabid anti-communist L.A. detective kind of thing. And it was really very, very special. And I still, had lots of relationships then. And so we took it to a powerful guy named John Landgraf, who is the head of FX and all of that world.
Yeah.
And John, I knew when he was an assistant's assistant. And John, we got finished with the pitch, and he looked at us, and he asked us one question. He said, is this a drama or a comedy? So that was one time Larry and I did that. We did other little things. Whenever I had a show, no matter what the auspices, whether we did one for ABC, we did one for Canada and Showtime, and then we did one for the Kids Network, the other one, not MTV.
Nickelodeon?
Nickelodeon.
Okay. Yeah.
But it wasn't Nickelodeon. It was third-tier Nickelodeon when we did South of Nowhere. But we always did stuff and just, became warmer. We had the interest in baseball. We're both not drinkers, but herbalists, and both interested in politics and this. And then Larry's gone on to do, the thing is, I'll buy his books. His books are terrific. I love his book, and I have to get into Shambhala now that it's out again. But his plays were just remarkable.
Let's shout him out. LarryMullen.com. You can get the books and all that stuff.
Yeah, so, and buy the rights to the play and put it on. They're great books. They really, truly are.
Yeah, did you hear about the whole thing that happened with his book where it was misprinted and they had to...
We stopped reading it and gave a little break. Yeah, it's just the difficulties of you know, communicating. But I guess they made restitution with them. So
sure.
The point is, the book's available now. So, you know,
I'm curious though. On the-
in fact, you know, I was going to start with this. We should do a little, you know, let's go, Pete. You and I together could do this because you know the what's the title of the book?
The road it was Shambhala, right? Yeah.
On the road to Shambhala.
Love it. Okay. Amazing, anyway, amazing.
This book, and this is the 90210.
Let me ask you this though. In terms of Larry's little debacle that happened, a lot of people don't realize that back in the day, you had a person who was the like you wrote the episode, but you had somebody that was like an assistant. Just how far we've come.
Right when that was starting, you know, people were moving from typewriting to different kinds of software. So the first time anybody ever asked me, what's the name of my software? What software do I use? I said, my software is Sherry. And Sherry was great. And, you know, and I did a lot of, you know, rewriting. I wouldn't retype. I would do, you know, 0.123. And often the values that I had brought into scripts, like this one, there was a lot of rewriting on. There's a lot of shared writing on this one for all sorts of reasons. But one of them is just, how do you actually structure the dialogue of a scene, you know, 1 to 10. And sometimes you can see that maybe 5 should be 8.
Sure.
And maybe the, you know, when you see it all there, you realize there's just a way. And my goal was always to draw less attention to the words,
mm-hmm.
but more what the dynamic going on in the scene is what I cared about. So yeah. Oftentimes when Luke would call me about the words, I'd want, as long as the same thing was being communicated, the words didn't mean quite as much to me, because it was the feeling of what's being communicated is what the audience needed to know more than the cleverness of a line here and there.
But I mean, I'm sure at sometimes you wrote a line specifically because it tied back into something else, or there was a reason why he had to deliver the line exactly as is.
Well, also, no, I even felt more, a little more in the comedy ones. I mean, we talked a little about what right. Every once in a while I would set up these beauties for Doug Emerson, and they didn't go out of the park. They ended up being like a double, maybe, you know,
yeah.
A long single off the wall. It didn't quite get the same full impact you want when you see it. So the words don't matter. It is more the feeling, really.
Sure. I love going back to the first season because it feels like when we watch a lot of seasons with you and Larry, we watch season three, and there seems to be a flow. Things seem to be happening. There's an order. We kind of know Donna. We know the characters. There's a process happening. You have new additional writers. You have a staff. But in this first season, you're figuring all of that out. You know what I mean? There isn't all those people. There's Jordan Booty, who we talked about, who has a story editing credit here. There's Star Froman. There's Amy Spies. There's some pieces.
Well, Amy was there right from the start because Amy went to Beverly Hills High School. So Amy knew with which what we were talking about. And the question was, you know, Barry Diller went to Beverly Hills High School, and this was going to, you know, well, it would be Beverly Hills. So what would that be like? And yet the Beverly High School that we went to was nothing like the one that we were being portrayed. You know, first of all, it was interesting to see the BYOB because my crowd in high school, nobody drank. And they didn't drink like, and if they did, they didn't drink like that.
Right.
You know, it was a time of smoking, it was a time of herbs, and that's what most people did, and they didn't. You know, it wasn't worth it. It wasn't Beverly Hills was not where you went for the kegger.
Right.
The kegger was not in the culture in 68, 69, 70. So what? 71, the era that I, even into 72 to the farthest out. So it was, you know, so even seeing that didn't feel like there's a party, let's go there. Not that there wasn't always alcohol. There always was alcohol, but it was cheap wine.
Right.
It was, mm-hmm. you know, cheap California wine was what, you know, was And yeah. Tasted god awful. That's why everybody was an herbalist.
What was it after sort of like those movies in the late 70s, early 80s, where we would see drinking at frat houses and all that kind of stuff, Animal House and all that? Is that sort of where we started seeing that in film and on television? Is that where that?
Well, if you think about it, well, remember Animal House is retro.
Yeah.
Well, Animal House comes out in the coolest part of the 70s.
Yeah.
Ruggiest part of the 70s, certainly, the late 77, 78, the period of when most pop culture is moving into disco.
Mm-hmm.
But those beer bashes. Now, in Wisconsin, yes, it was about the beer. Other places, it was about the beer. But we're talking Beverly Hills, you know, California. And believe me, when I did my freshman year in Wisconsin, it was a completely different set of mores, you know, because the smart, cute, political girls at Madison who were in the dorms were all virgins. The cute, politically active juniors and seniors at Beverly Hills High School were not. So just in that, in a way of looking at the world, would be different.
Got it. Mm-hmm. All right, so coming back to this first season, you're figuring it all out with Darren, and you're figuring it all out with Mr. Spelling, I would imagine. And
well, also there was David Sten was there, and he had influence.
That's a name we haven't heard too much in this
podcast. David Sten wrote The Green Room. David Sten wrote the first
one. So he was a writer that was producer. Brought...
I believe he took a pseudonym on East Side Story. I believe that's two writers there. Maybe it's just maybe he took no credit on it. I can't remember the official credit on that one. Yeah, David was hired by the Spelling Company and was someone who had done work for Fox he wrote ahead, just finished a book about Clara Bow.
Today, that, I mean, currently in
David Sten, he wrote a book about at the time back.
Oh, then, I see. I got you. Yeah,
coming out of Yale, and his editor was Jackie Kennedy Onassis. So he had a lot of cultural swag. He's who brought in Jane Trapnell, the costume supervisor for the first 12.
Interesting.
But when David left the show, she left with him.
Okay, so it's Darren, David, and Charles Rosen. That's the three that are going into making
this. And Aaron Spelling.
Of course.
And Amy Spies and Jordan Booty.
That's the group. And the team.
And they two weeks into it, when the Spelling Company is leaving their studio in West Hollywood, which was the Warner studio where Mr. Spelling's office was, after he had left 20th, where his office was as well, did a lot of shows up there, and he was leaving it, going into the office building on Wilshire Boulevard, which you see is the establishing shot of Melrose Place, where Heather worked. Mm-hmm. That's where our offices were. That's where Spelling moved into.
I feel like you used it in maybe The Pit and the Pendulum too. Perhaps, maybe. No, maybe not.
What?
The Pit and the Pendulum. Did you use that office? I thought I remembered that. Maybe I'm misremembering.
It's the 5800. It's right there on Wilshire Boulevard. It was just completed. Spelling Entertainment goes in there. And I had just been introduced to the Warner Hollywood by the facilities guy because we were there. We were setting up. We were having a little office area. But, of course, they were leaving. So the fact that they're leaving... I call the guy up and say, where are our offices in the new building? Silence. He comes back. He says, I'll call you back. And an hour later.
You knew right there.
That were going on that I was not privy to. But I did lean over to our UPM at the time, a nice man named John Liberti, and bummed a cigarette that I hadn't smoked in like 4 years because I realized, oh my God, how am I going to run the show without an office?
We don't have any offices here.
They had no offices. So where they ended up throwing us was in the back of a office complex in Hollywood and Santa Monica in a time when it was really kind of, you know, walk on the wild side. We're talking in the 90s. It was not a real safe part of town. Didn't feel it at all. It was a lot of cruising going on as well. And we were on McFadden there in the back of a whole post-production complex where they had just had an incredible season of Twin Peaks.
So you guys are sharing an office with Twin Peaks.
With the post-production department of Twin Peaks, because our other producers, it was Spelling, but it was also Propaganda. And Propaganda did all the post-production for Twin Peaks because it was the same coolness.
That makes sense. In a way, in a weird way. Yeah.
And Liglotta and, you know, just top directing at that point. That's what they were doing, you know, music videos for Madonna. Mm-hmm. Oh, and they also somehow got their hooks into through CAA in a 90210. So we're going to put them in the very back of this post-production thing. And, you know, you go walking in there with a bunch of young writers and you're a young writer yourself who's never done it before. That just physical setting is not really a great place to get command a lot of respect and order and you know, purpose and dialogue. So they basically, everybody had to go home at different points. And then, of course, the network didn't make it any easier by not accepting what we kept pitching them. So,
okay, tell me about that. So we always talk about the first 12. Did you know, were you guys going individually to say, I want to do this BYOB, someone's going to do Slumber Party? Did you know what the 12 were? How did you guys conceptualize?
Well, first it was the first six.
Even better, the first six.
And yeah. The thing about that is that the most important part about all of those was that the network executive on the other end of the phone and the person who was with them on that opposed every single thing we proposed. There wasn't one thing that we proposed that they liked. It was quite... it's quite a moment for me to hear the executive explain to me how to do serialized television because using St. Elsewhere as the example, since I wrote two of the first episodes of St. Elsewhere, was in the room when we actually had to break down a series much more complicated than the class of Beverly Hills at that point. It wasn't even called 90210 yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was not something that any of us were really geared up for. It was just, can we just get through this? And you're watching other shows not being able to run the gauntlet at Fox.
Right.
Fox didn't like anything. Cox didn't want to do anything. It was the Barry Diller personality that he never really owns up for how yes, he's had so many wonderful successes and so many things that just spectacularly breathtaking, all the money he's made. But he also caused so many more stress and problems than needed to be there because of the way that he approaches everything he did, including this company. Because a part of it was a real swagger. It was, you know, we're Fox with attitude. And you know, you had a pirate like Rupert Murdoch, and you had the indie guy Barry Diller wanting to scramble everything up and make sure the New Yorker liked it. And you know, and we're doing a high school show for Spelling. You know, what's it supposed to be? But, you know, as I've said times to you and others, you know, Aaron had a clear vision of what he wanted me to do as someone who was a successful movie of the week writer and writing a certain kind of television, a certain kind of way. And it was, you know, hard, but at the same time, every time I was having that conversation with that Fox executive on July 3rd, he would say, okay, let's go on to the next one. And I took that as a thing that he never went back to it. He never commented about it. So I took it as we could start writing it. Had we not written the first six, and we not had actual paper that they had to respond to, there would have been no green room. There would have been no Every Dream Has Its Price Tag. There would have been no The First Time. There would have been no one-on-one. There would have been no higher education. And there would have been no, with Jackie, and there would be no fashion.
Perfect.
So they would all just, none of them could have been done in time. And so the other shows that were dramas at the time, you've never heard of because they couldn't do a full season. Even if they went back and filmed it to fulfill a contractual obligation, they never aired.
Yeah.
It was a disaster. It was a total, you know, and, you know, the fact that we were able to swim through that gauntlet, that The Simpsons was able to swim through that gauntlet, that ultimately in Living Color was able to screw it, joined with Married with Children.
I was going
to
say Married with Children.
Yeah. And that was the Fox Broadcasting Company. Yeah.
And Parker Lewis Can't Lose, but that was canceled quickly, wasn't it?
It was two seasons, you know. I liked the, you know, it had. I know the people who did that. It was a that was very Peter Chernin. He ordered it. He wanted his show. His a lot of what was on the network was that. And I don't think the 90210 or Spelling fit in with a lot of the imagery of the Fox Broadcasting Company. As Barry Diller said at about, I think it was either after One on One. I think it probably was after One on One. But it could have easily been after the first time, because they were back to back, and unlike The Green Room and Every Dream Has Its Price Tag, where the network was and Spelling were kind of I don't know about this, the next two creatively were liked enough, particularly the first time.
Mm-hmm. The
and
first,
so yeah. So that's when Barry Diller said, "I don't know if this show belongs on your air." Our air, you know,
Fox.
And even though, yeah, because he realized it was an okay show, but is it the kind of show we should be doing?
Well, because, I mean, Married with Children is so provocative, and 90210 was kind of safe at that point, right? I mean.
Well, it looks back in the lens, it's safe now. No, yeah. Because you're dealing with teenage sexuality,
sure.
You're dealing with girls, and you're dealing with me writing it.
Yeah, that's so true.
It was not safe.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
It was not milquetoast.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that in that way,
I know what you mean.
You couldn't survive if it was too safe. It would have been.
It never would have made it.
But belonged on prime time. It wouldn't have been able to launch what we launched.
But you were able to do more things as that first 12. Like where we get to with BYOB is where we're going here. This is more. This is going a lot further than where we were, and maybe the Every Dream Has Its Price Tag, which is also shoplifting and whatnot.
Well, you know, I thought that, but I think it was erroneously in cheers to Amy Spees, I actually heard the words white privilege right in the middle in the heart of a script, and that was 1990 in
that's right.
September, August being written. I mean, that's so, you know, so I think there was a lot about that and the psychology of why do rich girls steal? I mean, I think
it's great. Yeah.
You know, so that one really, I think, was mischaracterized a lot. I think that we had the trouble when we went to the story about, you know, even you know, thinking, getting diverted with the idea of Cindy's affair, the 17-year itch and stuff. And that was basically, as I mentioned, you know, the network wanted us to do adult shows.
Yeah, but that was, I mean.
Nix that one. Yeah,
something is wrong with that episode. You know, I just feel like I think Carol's wonderful. You know, I think the actors are fine. But it just, you know, you want to see what's going on with Brandon. You don't care.
You don't want to see Brenda and Brenda's mother fuck somebody else.
No. No, and also the actor.
You don't want to think about it.
The actor was
not in this family.
No, exactly.
We weren't. We needed that not to be, because that would have been a Beverly Hills move.
Totally, Kelly's family. It's fine. Brandon's family. They just moved here. This does not seem like something that would have happened.
You know, it's funny. I've seen some stuff. At some point they were talking about in one of the chats or something, which, you know, I don't look at too much, but there was one there that caught my eye because it was about Andrea's relationship to her parents and how little we use that. Even when they showed up at the wedding, they just
That's right.
really were not characters. We just did not have room. We had room for grandma, and after dinner we just, you know, again, how much time do you have to develop something and where do you want to put your focus? And when you talk about where you put your focus, the other thing you're putting is where are you putting your money?
Right.
So the idea being that you want to get another character, another recurring character.
Well, the grandmother was fine. We didn't need, and you brought her back, I think, in season 4 or 5, right? So she does, yes, she comes back. So it's not like,
we had two different grandmothers.
Grandmothers.
That first one was Lainey Kazan.
She's so great, though. I mean, but you couldn't get Lainey to come back in season 5.
It was hard. It was not the right person to cast because of that. But Lainey actually, I think I mentioned this, and I haven't put props on that. Lainey's pediatrician was my father, and she loved my dad, so we were. We have that going on too behind the scenes.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
All right, so we get to this. We get to BYOB, and this is you and Jordan, and Amy has a credit in here too. So Amy Spees, or is it all Charles?
No, I don't think so. Amy was on the next one. One boy and a baby.
Right.
Or three boys and a baby. Whatever it was.
Whatever it is. Yeah. One boy.
No, that was Darren and Amy working together, and this was Jordan and I working together.
Now, IMDb has it listed as, it doesn't matter, you're just telling.
I don't, IMDb, when I did a show, South of Nowhere, it was a show that had been on for 2 years. Show was about, is very interesting, two lesbian high school girls who discover they're lesbians. And
very
it was
cool.
By a guy named Tommy Lynch. And we get to the third season. But the end of the second season, they have put themselves into a cul-de-sac that's over a cliff. Creatively, there is no effing place for them to go. How bad was it that they had to draw the old showrunner out who hadn't worked in 2 years to try to figure out how to narratively restructure? I hired Karen's cousin, Erica Mittman, who's gone on to have a wonderful career but couldn't quite get going. She was my assistant on Dawson's Creek.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to talk Dawson, you can always talk with her.
Yeah,
and she is also gay and now a gay mother in this, but in an interesting, wonderful relationship, wonderful person. She came in, so I got somebody who was as good enough to be a supervising producer and a top flight writer who won a Humanitas Awards for dealing with having to tell your grandparent you're gay. And has gone on to be a producer of Dexter, among probably that's her most commercial credit. So we turn this show around. She does a lot of it. I do a lot of it. Larry writes some. Karen writes some. And and once in a while, you know, because it's this company, you know, a guy comes in to do it. My partner on this one, and the series ends. We do it. We think we're maybe going to get another order, and we don't. A strike happens. Not going to be. I look at IMDb, and he has put himself down as the writer of every episode in season 3. So what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? Do I care enough?
No.
If somebody goes back and finds the right credit? No. I cared enough when it was a real live thing and it mattered.
Sure.
And people watched it. And it was an interesting show, very low budget and holds up if you ever can find it. But the fact is that, you know, I don't believe in IMDb. So whatever they say about IMDb, it's not the credits.
It's funny, Jenny and the other show, which we love all of them, but they constantly use IMDb as the source for who wrote it. And every week, Darren Stark gets credited as the writer of this episode. And somebody has to, you know, Shari Weiss, who we love here, will always point out that, no, Darren Stark wasn't even with the show at that time to be the writer of that. It's funny. All right, well, so let's talk about this episode. There's a lot of stuff that's happening here. By the way, this is like, I mean, for just between us, like talking about The Simpsons and some of that stuff is what Aaron and I want to do with the new 90 News. You know what I mean? Like some of those old shows that were on Fox that were coming up. So that's just for us. I don't know if I'll leave that in, but that's kind of like where we're
going. Listen, there are a lot of people around, interesting people. I mean, certainly everyone – has a great story in the beginning of Fox because Dillard didn't like any of the shows. Right. Didn't like Married with Children. I have someone for you to talk to about that. Mm-hmm. I used to have someone in Living Color, maybe still could for you. And the other one was The Simpsons. James Brooks left Fox over and moved to Sony because he had them that they had to put it on. That's how much Diller hated The Simpsons. The idea that he'd be doing a cartoon. It just wasn't his sensibility. They didn't really like any of the shows.
I mean, The Simpsons.
So that acknowledging that ours was okay was almost a throwback to his, you know, Barry Diller was credited, and in some ways deserved, of the creating the television movie, he and Aaron Spelling. Mm.
All right, let's get to this episode. So we have, I was going to ask you about Jordan Booty because he does write the secondary story, the B plot in this, where Jim and Cindy go to the retreat. I don't know, we called it a retreat in the episode, but it's a business conference, essentially, so we said that a business person might not look at it as a retreat.
They wouldn't look at it as a vacation. Would look at it as a corporate retreat, but a corporate retreat, and you know, at least in the 1990 TV perception of, we're going on one in Minneapolis or St. Paul, we're going up to this place or that, you know, in the state, versus a national place where you go for a retreat. When Karen and I went to the wedding recently in Arizona,
There
was a property in Phoenix called the Phoenician. And there, you know, there was the trial lawyers were there and the some brokers were there. And it's where you go to play golf and be able to write it off as education. And, you know, so definitely had it. And, you know, they talked about it being a 5+. You know, we make the, they had robes, terry cloth robes. Well, those were, you know, those were the Four Seasons in the Ritz-Carlton. You didn't get those in the Hilton. Now you do, but you didn't then, you know.
But the B plot is great. I mean, are they swingers? They're swingers and they're looking for a good time at the retreat, and they meet up with Jim and Cindy in the hot.
A little Lucy, ducky, ducky with you, Jimbo. It was Jordan made us all laugh. It was one of the really terrific, you know, as a playwright, he knew the world to talk about it, you know, very boozed up and completely, and it was zany. Let's face it. They just ran into the privacy of the Walsh bedroom or hotel room meant nothing.
And the casting was great on the two.
Rich Paul and both of them were just, we benefited with that. And I think the next one that you and I should do probably is Palm Springs Weekend.
Yes.
And we benefited by that, kind of just casting some real veteran actors, because at that point you're casting people in their late 60s or 70s. They're available to work and they're happy to work and they've got some skill sets and good talent, and we benefited by that in this episode, and we certainly benefited by it in the one I just mentioned.
And then of course the main plot, which we're going to talk about and go a little bit deeper with, is the whole Brandon. We do actually see Brandon dance here, which is interesting. We have the alcohol at the party, which we found out was at Donna's house, which we didn't think made any sense.
It felt like and also just because to reduce our overhead, the place felt kind of like a condo.
Yeah.
A little bit. It was up in the hill. It was a place that was available. Clearly, it was close to where our studio was, or mm-hmm. close enough in the foothills there. We saw Kelly and Steve trail up to bed, kind of what alcohol fueled the, you know, playing around. And the same thing again, but this time she didn't want to do it again, use alcohol, but be susceptible to that. But yeah, you know, in the same time, you get someone, you know, with a drink or two in them, it's 1990 or it's 2022. It doesn't matter. It's the same, you know, basic principle.
And you were critical when we did the watch along of this episode a little bit because it wasn't serialized and we were going because, you know, now what's going to happen is, we'll talk about the accident part, but, you know, some of the characteristics that we would never see out of Stephen Kelly or whatever, you were looking back on it saying, I don't know about that.
Well, the real, you know, what made me think about it today a little bit was that you look at these first 12, and where are the seminal episodes? In other words, and what I mean by that, where are the episodes where there is real character definition, where you are no longer Brenda Walsh going to be susceptible to doing some shoplifting,
right?
But be where you change your person. So if you think about it, you definitely, of the first six that we've gone through, the only one that really follows that test is the first time
where, yes,
Brandon is, and to some extent, but it's bigger than life. It's what David Senn wrote, The Green Room. It's the introduction of Dylan McKay.
Definitely.
Which is right. But that just was a hint of what could be. You don't get to number 9, Isn't It Romantic, where that comes. And that was on the heels of Brenda saying to Andrea and the rest of the people watching, take me seriously. I'm here for a reason.
Right.
You have those two. This one doesn't, you know, what's interesting about it in some ways is we talked about the anger and the idea of, here's Brand, he's been jettisoned out of what he knew, and he doesn't know the boundaries. He doesn't know what's played, how, what things are, what it's so to say, not that comfortable. And you see that he and Steve have not had that boundary then. And that's why when I've always said, you know, what's my favorite episode, it is Slumber Party. Because Slumber Party, Steve and Brandon were womb to tomb at that point. They now were,
yes,
at, and Brenda and Kelly and Andrea and Donna was there too, but so they were all for that, the women bonded, that they were going to be something, and it really pushed the series forward. That's number 12. And I think you also, you know, so out of that, we're talking about, you know, really four episodes, and you can't include this one.
You would, you
want to. What I think is the best part of the entire episode is the moment where Jim Walsh says, yes, I can be a harsh motherfucker, but you're my son, and I'm really glad you're alive, and I'm here. And it wasn't harsh. You know, Dean, Duke Vincent, I remember him criticizing some of the dialogue once he actually heard it in the party fish between Jim and Brandon with the car,
yeah,
and the tennis player Rattinger was his name,
yeah,
and the,
yeah,
with it. And the harshness of this, but this was the loving one. I'm going to be there for you, and so that was the closure. That was the you know. You don't have to prove yourself to me, son.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the family bond formed deeper there in this episode.
Yeah, but you know, the you know, and I remember, you know, when I was reading it on the page with Darren and saying, do we have a problem? And we called the network, do we have a problem? They didn't feel we had a problem.
And
Darren so much, I do not remember how he responded to it. He just went, well, we'll just... He responded to it the way he had to respond to it, which is, my episode's prepping. What are you talking about?
When you say, do we have a problem, do you mean that, in fact, because of the...
Why should he have been... He was driving the car...
In the next episode.
With the girl with the baby.
Right.
What was he doing driving the car so quickly?
Yeah. And it is a problem.
And it was just one of the reasons when I rail and say, well, we're the Rodney Dangerfield of television, and we weren't taken seriously in that. But some of the reasons we weren't taken seriously were we repeated an entire year of school. And, right. Oh, but that small little thing, we had things like this. We had real miscues where we just, as the women who called us to task on it by sending us a Western Union, you know, take us seriously. We're watching a television show. You want us to care.
It is interesting.
And I knew that. I mean, I pointed it out to them, and nobody cared. And we did give it to the network. And the network at this point, though, however, this was the period of time, hello, Gulf War. This is when it all shut down, and all of a sudden we became a different television show. This episode, I do not believe, was one of those that aired then. But the ones that did through the war were right after it, were the One Boy and a Baby and Slumber Party and East Side Story and Palm Springs Weekend is what took us out.
This was a requirement in my school, and I don't know about others, but in health class, we had to watch this episode of 90210. It's how I found Beverly Hills 90210. And then I watched the next week, and Brandon was driving. And there was that part of me that was like, what's happened? You know what I mean? Like, but it's interesting, too, because I'm sure in that time period, you didn't think, well, first of all, okay, by the end of the season, they'll get over it. You know what I mean? There's going to be so many other things.
This was just don't get canceled.
And 31 years later, people are still talking about the fact that the next week Brandon drove. You can never imagine that
That's right. We just, you just really didn't think that this was going to be the lasting one.
Right.
That this was going to be that this would be my, this was one like, you get your feet wet and you move on to other more serious shows.
Do you think the
idea that, what ended up happening is that, what went into a creative change in episodic television was that character-driven shows were less and less.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of shows that I would have loved to be, whether it be American Dreams or Friday Night Lights, they were just fewer of those kind of shows being offered and more procedurals and more reality shows in the scope of what a network was. And my bread and butter went away, which was the television movie. The television movie kind of serious. The if you go back and you look at the network television movies that were nominated for Emmys in from, let's say, 82 to 90, 88, those eras, they're really the top writers and top, projects, a lot more money into it. A TV movie about Attica would win, major prizes. We just had the movie, Coda win Best Academy Award.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of the best movies I'd ever seen was Love Is Never Silent. And that was a television movie for NBC. That I was actually given the script to rewrite, and I, because the network had notes, and I got back to the producer and said, don't change a word. That was my response to it. And she always, those women just passed away these last few years, but one of them particularly stayed a friend and always would thank me because it gave her the strength to fight for her script.
Yeah.
It ended up winning not only the best movie in television in the United States, but in the international, which believe me, United States never wins. It's always England or Italy.
Sure.
And now Israel.
Mm. So now, do you think this episode is, the accident is kind of shocking, right? I mean, it's not horrific by any means, but the fact that Brandon goes out, it seems like a normal party there. You know what I mean? That this is a thing that was going on probably at schools and kids were familiar with. They would have a little party. And then when you see, it's almost like when you hear in the episode where the woman says that she has HIV. You know what I mean? It's a shocking thing. You don't know that
I don't feel that they're analogous. We didn't build them, but we didn't earn the moment, Pete. We didn't
for sure.
Earn
it. I agree.
We didn't earn it from a production standpoint.
Yeah.
We didn't earn it from a sound standpoint. Yeah. It was, just get it done sloppy and less money. It was one that we at that point were just, trying to really hold on because what else are we, a guy's problem. And that's why they came back to me just about this time and said, Chuck, you're having all these social dramas. Let's do something fun. Like Brandon Goes to Hollywood. Hello, Lydia Lee. Famous Where You Find It.
Yeah.
That's what that came out of because, you just go, I mean, where we put Brandon in that moment was a real spot of darkness.
Yes.
And And, you know, we would see it periodically, as we talked about, with his gambling later and this kind of stuff. But it was, you know, if we would never have embarked on something like this. I mean, again, it was part of the first 12, just learning it. But sure. After that, this wouldn't have been appropriate in the second, even in the second season. Wouldn't have been so cavalier.
Yeah. Couple things more. Brandon and Andrea here have a little moment where he kisses her when he gets drunk. I know there's a whole group of Brandon Andrea fans, I mean, that wish that they were together somehow. We talked about that. But what do you think of this moment with Brandon and Andrea at the party?
Well, Andrea, what I took away watching it yesterday with you is Andrea enjoyed being kissed. She may have said, "You're drunk, and I don't like that." But also what she was saying was, and here I am, and ah. But then he was just a little too much. I mean, the loss of judgment wasn't getting so drunk. It was getting into the car and drive.
That's the problem, right.
And that was a really stupid thing to do. So it was really beneath him.
Yes. Yeah, I would never...
We could have made it more complicated that what he had to do with Steve, or it would be very simple. You know, we didn't have the moment where maybe someone... Brandon, you're driving two blocks.
Yeah,
you know, it's just around the thing. It's just right here.
Yeah, sure.
You know, or don't do me any favors. We'll do it all. Okay, come on. All right, I can do it. Don't worry. You know, we didn't earn the moment.
Yeah, and your mind at this point was okay. We got this one done. We're doing the next one, and we're off to the next one even after that. So that's where your mindset was. So there wasn't a hyper focus like there was.
My mindset was my mindset. If you want to be the truth, was this was it for me. Because we had 11 and 12, and then...
You weren't writing those.
What are they going to do after? Those are Darren's. What are we going to do after that?
Yeah.
We're going to wait to see what David Sten brings in. We're going to wait to see, you know, and then all of a sudden a war breaks out.
The Iraq war.
And what are they going to do with us?
So yeah.
it had changed, but you're asking me right at this point, I was not really... I mean, I was involved with the other. Don't get me wrong. There were notes. There was part of it. I'm part of the meeting in the... But we had made an agreement that we were doing this in more with teamwork.
You do this group, they do this one, they do that one.
That's right. How it was wanted, and when that was decided, and I remember that quite well, you know, because Paul had just started, and I'm being told of what the new situation's going to be, and I'm not saying a word. Just listening. I'm not even looking at anybody. I'm just, okay, this is what I got to do. And what the confidence that had to be found and was found was that Karen and I will write them under the table, and then they'll have to deal with us. So Karen and I wrote them under the table, and then they had to deal with us.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about Darren, and I'm not talking about Dave. I'm talking about the, you know, the spelling company and the network. If we do our best jobs as script writers and really deliver something good, what are you going to do then? Mm-hmm. And I remember David Sten, he was not a buddy, and he'd be the first to admit it. That I remember when he saw the rough cut of the Gentle Art of Listening, it was like this. That was, you know, it was going to be, oh my gosh, that one worked, didn't it? And then having the next one come, and really the other was because it was about romance, and romance being more the social issue. So we had, that was a real social issue driven. And by the way, the notion of doing the episode came from Dan McDermott. He was my network executive. He went through the new yearbook for the guys he worked for, the ones I'd been arguing, and he'd now been part of the team. And he looked forward, he said, this story seems kind of, this area seemed kind of interesting. That's all he had to say to me. And then we could work together. And that's it was creatively the kind of network relationship you want.
Mm-hmm.
That they're going to give you a springboard for ideas, and they're going to let you as the creative team kind of come to terms with those ideas.
Sure. Last thing too here is we see David and Kelly have a little dance moment, and this is the start of David's crush on Kelly, which eventually becomes his sister. But I mean, which is so great. This is so great to see the early David and Kelly sort of, he's really into her and he's speaking about
it. But I think even, you know, those first ones, that was something that really we take from the pilot.
Yes.
That was where they're in the pilot.
Sure.
Yeah. He was.
But they have this little dance moment here in this episode at the party.
Right, because to save me from Steve. Yeah.
Exactly.
And right. Dylan isn't really part of the equation.
Right.
He's off over here still. He's not really integrated in the group.
Yeah.
He's the wild boy.
So what were the do you remember what the ratings did you ever find out what the ratings were for this episode? Do we know what that information is, or we do not know? It's okay if we don't.
I didn't.
How did it
prepare
do?
That I would have thought that my producer would have prepared that, but anyway, we were not good. We were in the bottom. You know, we were in the bottom five for a long time, and I don't remember us getting out of that until post war, when they went back in the critics, and all of a sudden we were up lots of points. We were up 30. And it just kept going up. It would go up 10, 15 spots a week. Before we were the talk of the teen press and everything else, we were the talk of the industry that spring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did a special thing. They'd always do a thing at the Hollywood Radio and TV Society. It was a big deal lunch. And they would get together at the end, and they would put together, you know, like, what were the people... you know, who were there, you know, for the new year and coming in, who's the core of the business. And both Darren and I were on that stage. So we had made a huge jump very quickly.
You know,
the network, the Brandon Tartikoff and Ted Harbert, guys who were really network executives. This show is rising whether Fox knows what they're doing with it or not.
Interesting. When does David
tell the Interloper Network? You know,
sure. When does David Sten leave the equation?
David Sten turned in a draft of what later became East Side Story. Maybe that was the title he had to. I can't remember what that specific. And as he turned it in, he resigned. So that was we were filming probably just going in either ending prep or filming, you know, One Man and a Baby. It was a real tight thing. Mm. We were going into because Slumber Party was what we were shooting over Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so yeah. it was right the time. So
that must have been shocking. What are the three?
David, and I don't think it's wrong to say this, he beat me to the punch. I would have been fired him right then. But we, in the same way that later on, someone else was given their freedom to say that they had left the show. That's how the Spelling Company operated, and that was fine with me. There was no reason for me to make him feel bad, but we were not meshing, and
got it.
The version that he turned in was not where the show was going.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, this has been great covering BYOB. I think we got into all the stuff here. I mean,
we didn't get into what's her name with the gloves.
No, we didn't. Well, let me ask you about that because there is some interesting choices fashion wise. This is before Diane Kennedy, and there is a woman with
these. You can see the difference. There it is.
Purple gloves. Yeah.
Yeah, from someone. And whoever this extra was, it was like, am I going to. Dance with you, drink with you, go into a bedroom with you, or just eat you up right now and cut you up with a knife and fork. This was not this most inviting.
No.
Like, you know, like, oh, it would be wonderful. It was like, no, this is a scary moment. What TV show am I watching here? I mean, it was not the look that I remember when you'd go to parties and hoping to be a girl across the room.
Definitely not. No.
This was not that look.
No. Bad choice there for her. All right. Well, this has been great, man. We're going to keep covering episodes and deep diving into things. But
yeah, that's what you got getting from me. And it's fun for me to do it, so I hope you guys like it. And if you don't, Tell me which episode you want to do, and maybe we'll dig that one out. And yes, we're going to do some of the clunkers too.
We have to do them. Yeah, you know which one?
All that's left us here.
What I would love for us to cover is this episode with Larry, because I don't know if Larry was there though. The horse woman. We have to cover where Dylan meets the woman with the.
He wasn't there, but he can comment.
He can comment on it, maybe. Yeah. It's
well,
such a.
You should make friends. You should get back with Kenny Miller, and then we should get him on top.
Oof, boy, maybe we could find the horse woman, maybe.
Well, a lot of them are, yes, they're working actresses.
Yeah. All right. This has been great, man. Good seeing you. And I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah. Okay.
Baseball. All right. Yeah, but don't go yet.
Okay.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.